From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from London.
I'm a British serviceman that would like to say this. We should not take part in this war. Every British and American soldier should conscientiously object to this war because it is immoral, bankrupt, and wrong.
Today we speak with George Salamo, the first soldier to urge mass refusal to soldiers serving in Iraq. And his new video is broadcast of the abducted members of the Christian peacemaker teams in Iraq. We'll speak with a member of the CPT. But first, Lawless World, the whistleblowing account of how Bush and Blair are taking the law into their own hands. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from London. I'm Amy Goodman. Al Jazeera has broadcast new video of three of the four abducted members of the Christian peacemaker teams in Iraq. The silent 25-second footage carried a superimposed date of February 28th, 1 week ago today. British citizen Norman Kember and Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan were shown. U.S. citizen Tom Fox of Virginia was not on the tape. According to Al Jazeera, the men asked their governments to work for their release. The hostages were last seen all together in a video released January 28th, dated 1 week earlier. This weekend, the 100-day anniversary of their abduction was marked with vigils around the world. The peacemakers' kidnappers initially threatened to kill them unless all prisoners in U.S. and Iraqi detention centers were released. In other Iraq news, Britain's top military commander in Iraq has announced plans to withdraw nearly all of its soldiers by the summer of 2008. In an interview with the Daily Telegraph newspaper, Lieutenant General Nick Houghton said phased withdrawals would begin within weeks. However, Houghton said the pullout is ultimately contingent on Iraqi lawmakers forming a national coalition government and U.S. and British governments judging the Iraqi military ready to handle security. There are currently 8,000 British troops in Iraq. Meanwhile, the head of the Iraqi Army's Baghdad division was killed Monday when his vehicle came under attack. Major General Mabdar Hatim Hazia al-Dulaimi is one of the highest-ranking Iraqi military officials to lose their lives in insurgent violence. A U.S. military commander who oversaw the U.S. military contingent in Baghdad last year said of the general's death, quote, "It could be a blow that takes a long time to overcome." The incident was one of several Monday that left more than 20 people dead and 50 injured around Iraq. In the day's worst attack, five children were among seven people killed in a bombing in a crowded market in the town of Baquba. Another 17 people were injured. In comments, the Los Angeles Times calls among the frankest and bleakest public assessments of the Iraq situation by a high-level American official. U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad has warned of a full-blown civil war. Referring to the recent bombing of the Shia shrine in Samarra, Khalilzad said, quote, "If another incident occurs, Iraq is really vulnerable to it at this time." Khalilzad went on to say, quote, "We have opened the Pandora's box, and the question is, what is the way forward?" His comments come just days after General Peter Pace, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said things were, quote, "going very, very well in Iraq." Here in Britain, The Guardian of London is reporting the government has admitted aircraft thought to be used for the CIA's transfer of detainees has landed at local military airfields. The practice, known as extraordinary rendition, has raised public outcry across Europe over the use of its territory to transfer detainees who face torture. After months of silence on the issue, the British government disclosed the CIA landed 14 times at two bases between October 2003 and May 2004. In other news, the United States has dismissed the possibility of reaching a compromise in the international standoff over Iran's nuclear ambitions. Iran has been in talks to move its nuclear enrichment activities to Russia. The U.S. announced its stance after U.N. International Atomic Energy Agency head Mohammad al-Baradei said a deal between Moscow and Tehran could prevent Iran's referral to the U.N. Security Council. Meanwhile, U.N. Ambassador John Bolton has escalated talk of a possible U.S. attack on Iran. The Guardian of London reported Monday Bolton issued the threat at a meeting with British parliamentarians last week. According to one participant, Bolton said, quote, "They must know everything is on the table and they must understand what that means. We can hit different points along the line. You only have to take out one part of their nuclear operation to take the whole thing down," he said at a speech at the annual gathering of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, this Sunday. Bolton said the U.S. must be prepared to, quote, "use all the tools at our disposal to stop the threat that the Iranian regime poses." In the occupied territories, five Palestinians were killed Monday in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza City. The attack killed two members of the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad and three bystanders. Two of those killed were children aged 8 and 15 years old. An uncle of one of the dead who lived nearby also died of a heart attack. Another eight people were wounded. Meanwhile, in Israel, Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz defended Israel's policy of targeted killings and warned any Hamas leader could be hit. Mofaz said, quote, "If Hamas, a terror organization that doesn't recognize agreements with us and isn't willing to renounce violence, presents us with the challenge of having to confront a terror organization, then no one there will be immune." Referring to Hamas's prime minister designate, Mofaz went on to say, quote, "Not just Ismail Haniyeh. No one will be immune," he said. In military news, the U.S. Army has announced a new review of the death of former football star turned U.S. Ranger Pat Tillman. Tillman made headlines when he quit the NFL to fight after the September 11th attacks. He died while serving in Afghanistan, April 2004. The military initially misled his family into believing he was killed in battle, when in fact he was killed by U.S. troops. Tillman's death has already been probed on three separate occasions, but have only resulted in light punishment for some of his fellow soldiers. The new probes will focus on both the details of his shooting and allegations the Army covered up crucial facts after he was killed. A military spokesperson said earlier investigations had produced enough evidence to warrant possible charges of negligent homicide. In South Dakota, Governor Mike Rounds has signed legislation to ban all abortions in the state unless they're performed to save the life of the woman. Rounds said he expects a lengthy court battle over the new law. The measure comes as a similar effort is moving ahead in the state of Mississippi. In other news, the Supreme Court has ruled military recruiting must be allowed on college campuses that accept federal funding in a unanimous ruling. Justices rejected a free speech challenge from law schools that said they shouldn't be forced to accept recruitment so long as the military maintains a don't ask, don't tell policy on gay men and lesbians. The schools maintain the policy is discriminatory. At The Hague, a former Croatian Serb leader jailed for crimes against humanity has committed suicide. Milan Babic was serving a 13-year sentence after admitting to suppressing the non-Serb population in Croatia's Krajina region. Once an ally of Slobodan Milosevic, Babic testified against the former Yugoslav president at his ongoing trial. In Bolivia, President Evo Morales has accused the United States of blackmail for withdrawing $300,000 in grants. Morales said his country was told last week it's no longer considered a partner in the so-called war on terror.
We are under obligation to inform ourselves on this form of blackmail, threats, and intimidation to our armed forces. Because we don't accept vetoes or the change of a commander, blackmail comes from the U.S. Armed Forces.
President Morales won the presidency in Bolivia in December with more popular support than any Bolivian president in decades. He has drawn opposition from the Bush administration for his pledge to nationalize the country's vast natural gas reserves and his opposition to the U.S.-funded eradication of the coca crop. In New York, Cindy Sheehan and three other women were arrested at anti-war protest on Monday. Sheehan and the others were part of a march of U.S. and Iraqi women at the headquarters of the United Nations. The group attempted to deliver a petition signed by close to 70,000 people calling on the withdrawal of all troops and foreign fighters from Iraq. They were arrested for criminal trespass and resisting arrest. In other news, a group of environmental and civil rights groups has asked the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to investigate whether victims of Hurricane Katrina and workers employed in Gulf Coast reconstruction are being adequately treated by the U.S. government and federal contractors. Monique Hardin, co-director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights in New Orleans, said, quote, 6 months have passed, and these communities still look like the hurricane hit yesterday. And in Los Angeles, a group of urban farmers say they've won a court order to delay their eviction from land they've tended for over 30 years. Tenants of the South Central Farm are battling Los Angeles and a local real estate developer who plans to build commercial property on the land. The 14-acre property hosts the largest urban farm in the United States. 350 families use the farm to grow a multitude of crops. The stay will be in effect until at least next Monday. In a statement released on their website, www.southcentralfarmers.com, the group said, quote, to our knowledge, we can only be guaranteed to stall the eviction for days. This week will be critical in the history and fate of the farm. The farmers have been keeping up this fight for 3 years, but its victory is in the hands of the people, the statement said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from London on more than 400 radio and television stations around the United States, Canada, Europe, Australia. We're broadcasting on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, new evidence has emerged that President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair agreed in January of 2003 to attack Iraq, regardless of whether diplomatic efforts succeeded. The revelation comes in a newly updated version of the book Lawless World by British international law professor Philippe Sands. According to the book, Blair offered Bush his full support of the war during a meeting at the White House in January 2003. Sands says his account is based on a summary of the meeting prepared by one of the participants. According to the book, Bush is recorded as saying that, quote, the start date for the military campaign was now penciled in for March 10th. That was when the bombing would begin. The military timetable meant that an early resolution was needed. Bush also reportedly said the, quote, diplomatic strategy had to be arranged around the military planning. In addition, the book reveals President Bush told Blair that the United States was considering flying U-2 spy planes disguised as United Nations planes over Iraq in an attempt to provoke Saddam Hussein. If Iraq fired on the planes, it would help justify a U.S.-led invasion. We're joined now in London by Philippe Sands, the author of Lawless World. He's a professor of international law at University College London. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Very nice to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you talk about this, what you call the White House memo?
Well, the White House memo was a document that I've added into the latest edition in the UK, and it describes a meeting well known to have been held between President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair on the 31st of January 2003, just 5 days before Colin Powell gave his famous presentation to the Security Council. What's so striking about the material, which has not been challenged as not being authentic, is that it confirms the absence of evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Why would the British Prime Minister and the American President be talking about the possibility of provoking a material breach if they had clear and compelling evidence. But more importantly, it also confirms, as some have thought and some have said, that the road to a second resolution was a sham, that the decision had already been taken, that already by the end of January, a start date for the war was penciled in and the decision was set in stone, and that both Bush and Blair had agreed.
Now, Philip Sands, I want you to say again what this plan was. What was it that President Bush proposed?
Well, according to the minute of the meeting, which is prepared by one of the participants, at one point, President Bush tells the British Prime Minister that he has other things in mind. And what he suggests is the possibility that the United States would take some of its own spy planes, paint them in United Nations colors, put them in the air above Iraq, provoke Saddam to attack them, and when Saddam did attack them, he would then be in material breach, and that would justify the use of force for violating earlier Security Council resolutions. The simple point is, why do you do that if you've got hard evidence of weapons of mass destruction?
Has the UN responded?
The UN hasn't responded to any of that. The White House has responded, and Downing Street have responded. Downing Street has said they don't do book reviews and that they there's no decision to start the war until the 18th of March 2003. But there's no inconsistency between the two. The 18th of March date in the UK was the date when Parliament voted for war. It's pretty clear to me, as people have long suspected, that the British Prime Minister himself had long before decided to join President Bush in the road to war in Iraq.
You called this the White House memo. Do you want to say which participant revealed it to you?
I'm not able at this point to go beyond what is in the book. I've referred to it as the White House memo because it refers to a meeting held in the White House. That's not in dispute. Interestingly, President Bush himself, in his conversations with Bob Woodward in another book, Plan of Attack, refers to the 31st of January meeting as the famous second resolution meeting. So it's clear that something important happened. I think that's the moment at which the American president told his British ally he was going ahead irrespective of the UN route.
Now, you also revealed the first Downing Street memo. Can you explain what that is? And for American listeners and viewers, why these are referred to as Downing Street memos?
The Downing Street memo refers to a much earlier text from July 2002, so about 9 months earlier. And it refers to a meeting held by parts of the British cabinet who were discussing the British government's strategy for dealing with the Iraq situation. Piecing the whole thing together, what becomes very clear is this. In March and April 2002, President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair meet at Camp Crawford and they agree on a strategy, which is to go the weapons of mass destruction route. That's revealed in the Downing Street memo. They then go the UN Security Council route. They get a first resolution. It doesn't authorize the use of force. They have to prove that Saddam's in material breach. They're unable to do that because Mr. Blix and Mr. El-Baradei don't deliver the goods, and they are then left really flailing around trying to find other ways to justify a use of force that was, in my view, wholly illegal.
We're talking to Philip Sands. He's professor of international law at University College London and author of the book Lawless World, America and the Making and Breaking of Global Rules from FDR's Atlantic Charter to George W. Bush's Illegal War. In the paperback edition that has just recently come out is where you reveal the White House memo about President Bush wanting to put UN markings on a U.S. spy plane to provoke Saddam Hussein. Let's talk about legality of war. You're an international law professor. Are we seeing the use of international law, the discussions about the violation of it, more than we've ever seen before?
We are, and it's a result, if one is clear about it, of a very positive effort made by the United States dating back to the 1940s. My book starts in August 1941 at a meeting between Roosevelt and Churchill off the coast of Newfoundland when Churchill and Roosevelt agree they're going to put in place a new world order, a world order based on rules. In the 8 years that followed, they put in place, together with other countries, the modern system of international laws, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the Geneva Conventions on the Treatment of Prisoners of War, the Nuremberg Statute, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the Genocide Convention, all of the instruments that we've come to know in the modern system, the basic principle being the dignity of human individuals would be protected, the use of force would essentially be outlawed, except in special circumstances, self-defense, for example. It's a US system supported by the British, intended to promote American values, American constitutional values. Fast forward 60 years, and the administration that now holds office sees these rules, which for several administrations were seen as promoting American opportunities, promoting American values, as imposing constraints. And what we saw after 9/11 was the decision, effectively, to cast aside the rules, to create the legal black hole at Guantanamo, to unbound the US president, to allow him to authorize interrogation, including the use of torture, and, of course, to prosecute a war in Iraq that did not meet the very rules the United States had put in place. So that's a fundamental challenge to the international rules.
I wanted to talk to you, Philippe Sands, about a case you were very involved with, and that's the case of Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean dictator, who was arrested here in England on, what was it, October 16, 1998. Can you talk about on what grounds he was arrested, how he was held here, and how significant this is for what's happening in the world today?
It's very significant for what's happening in the world today, and I'll explain why. Senator Pinochet was arrested on allegations of torture, disappearance of people, murder. At the end of the day, it boiled down to issues of torture. The allegation was that his government had exercised torture after it came into office on another September the 11th, 1973, over a period of 18 or so years. When he arrived in London in the autumn of 1998, he was slapped with an arrest warrant alleging, amongst other things, torture. And the basis for the arrest warrant, which came not from the United Kingdom, but from a Spanish prosecutor, was a 1984 convention prohibiting torture. And the significance of the convention, to which the United States is a party, Chile is a party, Spain is a party, the UK is a party, is that it prohibits torture anywhere in the world, and it gives any country in the world the right to exercise jurisdiction over torture. So if someone authorizes torture in the United States, if torture takes place in Afghanistan or in Iraq, that person in the United States is liable to the jurisdiction of any court in the world. You can see straight away the significance of that decision. The decision goes even further, because what it says is, even if you were a head of state, you are not entitled to claim immunity from the jurisdiction. You can't say, oh, well, I was a head of state at the time it happened. You can't bring me before your courts. Senator Pinochet ran that argument, and he lost that argument. What that means in principle, and of course everything turns on the facts, is that in relation to those in the United States who may have signed off on the authorization of torture, from lawyers like John Yoo right up to Secretary Rumsfeld, perhaps even up to the vice president, and perhaps even up to the president of the United States, once they are out of office, they will not be able to claim immunity if there is hard evidence of involvement in complicity in torture. That's a very significant implication.
It's interesting. Isn't the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, in London now?
The Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, has been talking this morning at the International Institute of Strategic Studies. I spoke there a week ago. I was a sort of aperitif, a warm-up act for what he had to say. Needless to say, my message was rather different from his. But it's the same Mr. Gonzalez who, of course, describes the Geneva Conventions, which provide vital treatment, vital protections for prisoners of war, including American prisoners of war, as quaint, as obsolete, as no longer applicable in relation to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda individuals. And it's the same Mr. Gonzalez who, of course, contributed to the signing off of memoranda authorizing what in Britain is considered to be torture.
Now, this may sound like a stupid question, but it's always said once a person leaves office, because when they're in office, they're guaranteed immunity. Why are they guaranteed immunity when they're in office?
They're guaranteed immunity whilst they're in office essentially to allow states to continue to interact. So states have decided that it would be inappropriate for a situation in which the US president could not travel to Spain, for example, with a threat of an arrest warrant being thrown on him. The logic for that disappears once the individual is out of office, because that person no longer exercises governmental functions.
Mm-hmm. Of course, countries could say, you can't come as head of state to our country. Didn't they do that with Kurt Waldheim when it was discovered his involvement in the Holocaust, yet he was president of Austria? He wasn't allowed into the United States.
Countries can do that. I suspect we're a long way from that in relation to either the British prime minister or the American president. And I want to make clear that all of this, of course, turns on the facts. And we're still at a situation where most of the facts are yet to emerge. But the suspicion that many of us have is that once Mr. Blair and President Bush leave office, a great deal more material is going to emerge.
Philippe Sands, what about the significance of, just in these last few days, Tony Blair's wife saying, she too, a lawyer, saying that torture is not acceptable? How significant is this?
Well, Cherie Booth, who is the British Prime Minister's wife, of course, is a colleague of mine in my chambers, so I'm always very careful what I have to say about her. She's a terrific colleague, and she's obviously someone who's strongly committed to the protection of fundamental human rights. She gave a speech about a week ago at Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, for a US organization, actually, Human Rights Watch, in which she reiterated her personal conviction that under international law there are no circumstances, none, even ticking time bomb, in which the use of torture is permitted. And that sent out a signal that I think at the upper echelons of English society, the international prohibition on torture is set in stone, is absolute, and is a line that cannot be crossed, not only for legal reasons, for moral reasons, for political reasons, for ethical reasons.
Explain ticking time bomb, even in the case of ticking time bomb.
Ticking time bomb is the scenario that is put to me very often in relation to my own position. What if I were told that the school at which my children attended may have a bomb placed in or near it, but we don't know precisely where? In those circumstances, if plausible evidence emerges that someone knows where the bomb is going to be, is torture not justified? And I have to say that's the difficult question that the Israeli Supreme Court said in a landmark judgment concerning the use of torture in Israel, to its credit, ruling that torture was not justified. When faced with that argument, they said, well, let's deal with that situation when we get there. That has not happened on any plausible situation. And, of course, the underlying rationale for the prohibition against torture is that it doesn't produce concrete evidence. It doesn't produce material on which one can rely. That's the real problem with torture material.
And this latest news that has just come out today, reported here from London, about the so-called extraordinary rendition flights, what others simply call kidnapping, that planes, CIA planes, it has been admitted more than a dozen, landed at British military airfields. How significant is this, and how does this fit into international law?
It may or may not be significant in this sense. Under international law, the obligation to eradicate the use of torture completely is absolute. So there are no circumstances in which torture is permissible. But the obligation goes further than that. States which know or should have known that another state is engaging in torture are under a positive obligation to inquire as to what is going on. So if the British government knew or should have known that these flights were carrying individuals or transporting individuals to places where they might be tortured, where there was a risk that they were being tortured, they have a duty to find out, to inform themselves. If they knew or should have known and did nothing about it, then arguably, depending on the facts, they could be complicit in torture and themselves internationally responsible for contributing to an international crime.
Do you think Bush and Blair should be arrested?
I think that that turns on the facts. Let me focus on the issue of the Iraqi war. The Iraqi war was, in my view, wholly illegal. It wasn't justified on classical grounds of international law. Self-defense wasn't even argued. The justification that the Security Council authorized the use of force, in my view, is not really a plausible argument. The Deputy Foreign Office legal advisor, Elizabeth Wilmshurst, resigned on the 18th of March, 2003. She resigned in her resignation letter, which I describe in the book, because she could not be party to what she described as an illegal war that would amount to the crime of aggression. The crime of aggression is an international crime. And if indeed it was an illegal war, both the two individuals, together with the Australian Prime Minister and the Spanish Prime Minister, are at risk, if you like, of future investigation for participating in an illegal war. And in fact, I conclude the latest edition of the book with the suggestion that once out of office, Mr. Blair will obviously want to think very carefully, having regard to the Pinochet case, as to where he may want to travel.
Now, Pinochet ultimately was freed here in Britain and sent back to Chile.
He was freed. He spent about 16 months locked up, actually, in rather luxurious conditions in a very large house in the south of London. But still, he was incarcerated, and his reputation, obviously, was deeply damaged by what happened. He was released off the back of a claim by the British, Chilean, Spanish governments that he was no longer healthy enough to face criminal prosecution and to, if you like, withstand trial in Spain. That, of course, was 7 years ago now, and his health seems, in the circumstances, to be remarkably robust. But I don't focus too much on the fact that he was sent back. But the most important point about those proceedings was that they established the principle that under international law, no one is above the law. However important they are subject to the international rule of law, and they cannot travel freely without risk of investigation or arrest.
And the other point that you've made in your book, Lawless World, about the manipulation of what the, well, what's equivalent to the Attorney General in the United States here in this country, the recommendation he gave to the Prime Minister, Blair.
Well, unlike the United States, where the issue of international law, frankly, was a non-issue and most people didn't care about it, you may have covered it, but most American media channels were simply not interested. In Britain, it became, and still is, a very live, powerful issue. And the British Prime Minister made clear that he would not proceed to the use of force against Iraq unless he was satisfied that it was consistent with international law. Now, we now know, and the book revealed the whole story, of the circumstances in which the British Attorney General, Mr. Gonzalez's equivalent, a man called Lord Goldsmith, first gave secret legal advice, which was, shall we say, equivocal about the arguments put forward by the US for the use of force, just 10 days before force was used. He then changed his mind in circumstances that have never been fully explained, but which have given rise to the suggestion that he was leaned on politically to change his mind. And that has continued to be a live political issue in the United Kingdom. An analogy has been drawn between, on the one hand, as you say, the manipulation of the evidence of intelligence of weapons of mass destruction, and on the other hand, the legal arguments that have been made to justify the use of force. The upshot of all of this is that we've sort of lost faith in government. When they tell us that they have certain facts, a lot of people are skeptical now, and that's unfortunate.
Philippe Sands, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I want to conclude by just reading the first paragraph of a piece in the Guardian newspaper, which says, when at last the definitive history of the war against Iraq comes to be written, some readers may be surprised to learn that it was a lawyer who most dented the Prime Minister's credibility. The Today program may have scored a few glancing blows, and Labour backbenchers and the anti-war movement may have landed the odd punch. But it was Philippe Sands, professor of international law at University College London, who stuck the knife into the heart of Tony Blair's claims for the legality of the war in his book, Lawless World. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we're going to speak with the first British soldier who called on his colleagues, other soldiers, both British and U.S., to do what he did, to refuse to serve in Iraq. Stay with us. And battle come down, London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is going thin. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning. I live by the river, to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't wanna shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice is just coming, the sun's zooming in. Engines stop running, the wheat is going thick. A nuclear error, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning. I live by the river. London Calling by The Clash. And yes, we are broadcasting from London today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. USA Today is reporting at least 8,000 men and women have now deserted the U.S. military since the United States invaded Iraq 3 years ago. And many observers believe the actual number may even be higher. The GI Rights Hotline reports that it now receives up to 4,000 calls per month from soldiers seeking a way out of the military. Before the invasion, the hotline received about 1,000 calls per year. Here in Britain, soldiers are also refusing to fight in the war. Today, we're joined in London by Lance Corporal George Salamou. Last January, he resigned from the London Regiment of the Territorial Army, known as the TA. At the time, he said, quote, "I want to act as a beacon, a rallying point for other soldiers. We don't have to go quietly. This war is wrong. I call upon other soldiers to conscientiously object to this war." Along with George Salamou, we're joined by Lindsay German, organizer with one of Britain's premier anti-war groups called Stop the War Coalition. She's co-editor of the book Stop the War, the story of Britain's biggest mass movement. The Stop the War Coalition is organizing a major demonstration in London on March 18th to mark the third anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
George Salamou, let's begin with you. When did you become a part of the British Army, the Territorial Army?
I think about 5 years I spent with the Army, so it was around about 1999, around about that period.
You joined?
I joined, yes.
Why?
Why? Because I wanted to serve my country. I wanted to give the country that brought me up, that educated me, that nursed me through the healthy system, everything, something back. And I think that's important, to give something back, not always take.
So what changed?
What changed? What fundamentally changed for me, that remember, this was the era in 1999 when the Labour Party was coming to power as well, and there was a point where the Labour Party said we were going to have a new foreign policy, a more ethical foreign policy. And I thought that I could, as somebody who's politically minded, can join the army and actually take part in the military under the auspices that there would not be unjust and immoral wars, that we would have an ethical foreign policy. Sadly, that didn't come to fruition.
So what happened? How did you make the decision to refuse to serve in Iraq?
Myself, like many of my comrades that were part of the regiment, many of us made different ways of conscientiously objecting. Some of us resigned. Quite a few of my friends resigned. Others just didn't turn up to the army base and then got pensioned off and told not to return because their training wasn't up to date. I personally got to a point where I went to a Stop the War rally and in Hackney, the area where I live, and I just stood up at that meeting and said, look, I can't stomach this war anymore. What can I do to stop it? And from that moment on, colleagues in the anti-war movement contacted me, and we contacted lawyers and other people and found out that I could conscientiously object, because all this information is hidden from soldiers, and it's enshrined in the UN charters as well.
What do you mean, hidden?
It's hidden. It's basically hidden. When you get your call-up papers, you're given the classification of why you're being called up and the categories of how you can get out of your call-up through being in full-time education, if you have a part of a business, or you are caring for an ill or relative, so forth. But the part of the papers that should say that you can conscientiously object is not there, and that is wrong, and it's against the law, UN law as well as European law.
How many British soldiers are serving in Iraq?
At the present moment, it fluctuates about 8,000.
Mm-hmm. And what have British soldiers said to you about what you're doing? And tell us what you were doing. You were a medic?
Yes, I was a medic. The army's very short of medics, so I was earmarked to go out to Iraq. Lucky enough, I had a great amount of support, only from a few officers that I got any negative comments, but for the vast majority of the soldiers who I have served with, they've supported me. And it's unbelievable that men can go to a war which they don't believe in, but that has been part of history. And many of my comrades have gone out to Iraq and returned and resigned since then and not made any political comment about the war, even if they tell me when we sit down for a drink in a bar that it was the biggest waste of their life and the war is totally bankrupt.
How wounded are these men who come home, both physically and psychologically?
How wounded? I've got two friends that are now seeking psychiatric help. One friend who lost an eye, one friend who's crippled for life, and was going to come out with me as a conscientious objector to the war. But the Ministry of Defence got to him and warned him that his pension rights and money that he received from the army for his wounds would be curtailed. And sadly, he was unable to come out with me against the war.
Well, what about you? Were you threatened?
No, I was ignored, basically. You see, the week that I made the public statement at the Houses of Parliament and other places, that was a very bad week for the British Army. There was a lot of negative stories about British soldiers involved in torture, British soldiers who had died. And they were very worried, I think, the MOD was very worried that this would get a lot of press. It did get press, but their hope was that it would quietly go away. And lucky enough, it hasn't quietly gone away. But the problem is getting the message out to the soldiers, which I'm campaigning for. Only on the 13th of this month, I'm going to Strasbourg to appear in front of the MEPs and to put
MEPs.
My ministers of Parliament, of European Parliament, to discuss the fact that England, as well as other European countries, are in contribution, not publicly letting British soldiers know the truth about the ability to conscientiously object against this war.
So how does it work here? You applied for conscientious objector status?
Yes, you basically apply. You have to apply before you're actually called up. You have to write a letter to your commanding officer, say that I'm not willing to take part in this war, give the grounds that you wish to object on. They may be moral, religious, ethical, or political. From then, you will be given an interview, and that will be recorded. So when you finally do get your call-up papers, then they'll be able to take it to a tribunal, and the tribunal will be able to decide from there.
So what was the response to your request?
Zero. They wouldn't even reply to my letters. And I did it very publicly. I wrote to them twice, registered letters, as well as writing in The Independent and The Guardian that my comments that I was conscientiously objecting, and they would not reply to me.
Lindsay German of Stop the War campaign, how significant is it to have soldiers like George Salamo joining your movement?
Well, it's very significant indeed, and we're very, very grateful to all of them because they've made a huge difference to our campaign. And
how many of them are there?
Well, we're in touch with, we think we're in quite close touch with something like a third of the families who've lost sons or relatives in Iraq, which is just over 100 now. So we're in touch with something like 30. There are others who are beginning to come forward who now have still people serving in Iraq who want to campaign against the war, hopefully before anything happens to their children. So it makes a big impact on it, and they obviously make a big impact on people in Britain, because for people to say we believe that this was a war that was brought under false pretenses, we believe our children joined the army in order to fight in what they might regard as a war which was justified. The fact that most people don't regard this war as justified in Britain or indeed in many parts of the world makes them even more obviously upset at their loss, but also concerned to try and campaign against it.
Paint a picture of your movement, of the Stop the War campaign. How large is it? How much coverage does it get? Who is a part of it?
Well, we started it after 9/11, so it's been going nearly 5 years now, and we campaigned firstly against the war in Afghanistan and then against, obviously, the war in Iraq. Now we're campaigning again to stop troops going to Afghanistan and against the war in Iran. So we campaign around all those issues. It's a very big campaign. We have, from the very beginning, a number of components, including national trade unions, who make up a significant part of it.
Trade unions?
Well, we have most of them. We have the Transport in General, the General Municipal, George's own Unison Union, which is the local government workers, the civil servants, the college lecturers, the journalists. We've got lots and lots of them who have always supported us, and we're very, very grateful to them. The rail workers, both the main rail workers' unions. So that's important for us. We've always had Muslim community support, and that continues. Traditional peace activists through CND and through the
campaign for nuclear disarmament.
Yes, the people who've campaigned and still campaign against Trident, against bases, nuclear bases in this country. So a very broad campaign, and a campaign which just keeps going, really, because, of course, there is always a great deal to campaign against.
What about the terrorism laws that are coming down? Some have already passed, some are being considered in this week, and we're going to talk more about this in this week as we broadcast from London with others. But are people afraid to come forward, particularly Muslims in Britain?
Well, I think there's a great deal of anxiety among Muslims, because particularly with some of the older people who fear very much that their children are going to be stopped and searched, as they are, and that they're going to be criminalised and discriminated against. But there's also a degree of anger at the laws, both among non-Muslims, people who feel that these are worse laws than we had even during the Second World War, and also among the Muslims themselves. So there have been big demonstrations recently about the question of the cartoons, the Danish cartoons, demonstrations of Muslims. But they also raise
the
questions
like... The cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad.
Yes, that's right. But they also raise the other questions like civil liberties, because people are very concerned about them.
How linked are you with the U.S. peace movement and for other countries, for that matter?
Well, March the 18th is going to be an International Day of Action. We've made a number of links with the U.S. peace movement, which we're very happy about. We feel not enough. We feel one of the things we failed to do in the last two or three years has been to make sufficient links. But we have made links with United for Peace and Justice, with ANSWER, with a number of individuals. We had Cindy Sheehan at our peace conference in December. So a whole number of people, the Military Families Speak Out, have been over here as well. And we find that a very, very useful thing. Plus, we do now have links from Venezuela. We've got demonstrations happening in Basra and Baghdad on March the 18th, which we're very proud of, right across to Japan.
What do you mean, protests in Basra?
Well, there's going to be a demonstration against oil privatisation and against the troops being there, which the Oil Workers Union is organising.
The Iraqi oil.
Yes, that's right. And there will also be a demonstration in Baghdad, which I don't know exactly what form that will take, because obviously it's very, very difficult for people to demonstrate.
George Salamou, what about your linkages with U.S. soldiers?
Well, what we do try to communicate with each other through the American organizations, as well as via the internet. I mean, I've got personal contacts, people that do phone me up, and we just talk. But obviously, all this is about galvanizing people and getting them to come together, and we are forging better and better links as time goes on. I mean, Cindy Sheehan was here in the peace conference only in the end of the last year. December, yeah.
She was just arrested yesterday outside the United Nations.
Oh, really?
In New York.
Yes, as she marched with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink and Iraqi women who had come from Iraq to bring a message. Not all of them could come. There was supposed to be a delegation of seven of them. Two of them were prevented from coming, two Iraqi women. Their families had been killed by the U.S. military, and when they applied for their visa, the State Department told Medea Benjamin that the reason they were denied was because they were afraid that they would not wanted to go back to Iraq because they didn't have families to go back to and perhaps stay in the United States.
Well, that's catch-22 for you, isn't it, really?
But, George, on the issue of the military, there's been a lot in the United States about soldiers involved with abuse in Iraq. British soldiers have been tried, a few of them. Can you talk about that?
Can I talk about that? Well, I think it for any soldier, and for those, when I talk about my friends that have already been out there, abuse is systematic, there's no doubt about it. I mean, and it doesn't have to be the glorified pictures of people being beaten. I mean, when, for example, I spoke to friends that were on search missions where they had to go into people's homes, and
literally went into people's homes and just rounded them up and put them on lorries. They didn't know what was going to happen to those people. They were given an order to go into people's homes, smash the door down, and go in terrified people and pick them up and take them off. And now we even know from today, I mean, the last results were that there is in the region of 14,000 people illegally detained in Iraq. Mm. With they haven't been charged, some of them up to a year, some of them now coming close to 2 years. Now, that is a crime. That's a crime against humanity. That's in breach of the UN charters as well. Now, that's why I say when conscientious objection is more than just saying that the war is wrong. It's about not taking part in it. And every soldier has a little part to play. But fundamentally, that little part leads up to a bigger part, which is the war crime which is taking place in Iraq.
George, what is your answer to soldiers who would say, I don't want to go to Iraq, but I don't want to desert my buddies?
You have a right under the UN Charter to conscientiously object to the war. I'm not sure exactly what the American law is, but I know the British law allows you to do that. And I'm sure if American law is in line with UN law, then they have as much right, and they should research it and get in contact with representatives of the legal team in the UN to find out if they can.
That feeling, though, of leaving the people you trained with to go to war without you?
Personally, for me, I knew, as a medic, I know I could have went out to Iraq and saved lives, but I feel I saved more lives by campaigning against this war. I saved more British lives, I saved more American lives, and more Iraqi lives by not taking part in this war.
Well, George Salamo, I want to thank you very much for joining us. A former soldier in the British Territorial Army, was in the Royal Army Medical Corps, attached to the London Irish Rifles, publicly resigned from the Army January 2005 in protest of the Iraq War. And Lindsay German, thanks for joining us, convener of the Stop the War Coalition here in London, where we're broadcasting from. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Christian Peacemaker Team. The four members who've been kidnapped have been held now for more than 100 days. Stay with us. Music by the late Ali Farka Touré. He died earlier today at his home in Mali, one of Africa's most famous musicians. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from London. I'm Amy Goodman. Christian peacemaker teams have been kidnapped now for more than 100 days in Iraq. Al Jazeera has broadcast new video of three of the four abducted members of CPT. The silent 25-second footage carried a superimposed date of February 28th, 1 week ago today. British citizen Norman Kember and Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan were shown. U.S. citizen Tom Fox of Virginia was not on the videotape. According to Al Jazeera, the men asked their governments to work for their release. The hostages were last seen all together in a video released January 28th, dated 1 week earlier. This past weekend, the 100-day anniversary of their abduction was marked with vigils around the world. The peacemakers, kidnappers, initially threatened to kill them unless all prisoners in U.S. and Iraqi detention centers were released. We're now joined here in London by Tim Nafziger, a member of the Christian peacemaker teams in Britain. We welcome you to Democracy Now! This weekend, you held a vigil.
That's right. About 100 of us gathered in Trafalgar Square. We had doves there to symbolize our hopes for both peace and for the liberation of our friends, and also for some of the 14,000 detainees in Iraq being held without charge. And it was a meaningful time. We had prayers from Buddhist tradition, Muslim tradition, and Christian tradition there.
You knew Norman Kember.
That's right.
Can you talk about him,
sure.
What he has done over the years?
Norman's been part of the peace movement here for 50 years. I've only known him for the last two, so I can hardly speak.
He's, what, 74 years old?
And so this is part of his lifelong vocation. And his trip to Iraq was part of that, but it was only a small part of what he's done. He's one of the organizations networks I work with is called Network of Christian Peace Organizations, of which Norman is the treasurer. We just met this Saturday and realized, well, what do? Norman has all the accounts. So this is very much, we need him back here to continue his work with a wide variety of organizations.
Can you talk about his work?
Mm-hmm. Norman, one of the photos that's been in the press is him going to 10 Downing Street and delivering petitions there. He was always had creative ways to be involved and to be a voice for peace. So it was everything from the routine of accounts to showing up at demonstrations with creative costumes or creative signs that really expressed both his faith and his hope for peace in the world.
You hold vigils every Wednesday?
That's right.
For the Christian Peacemaker?
For the four men, those are organized by Fellowship of Reconciliation and Pax Christi, which are also organizations that Norman worked with.
Your reaction to the latest videotape that shows Norman Kember and two of the three others kidnapped?
It's good to see them alive, and it's good to see that they're well, considering what they've been through. And we hope that they will be released and that this video is a signal of their continued a hope and continued possibility. So we'd invite people to join us at from 6 to 7 Wednesday evening in Trafalgar Square to continue our vigil.
And any message to the kidnappers?
Well, like I said earlier, Norman's continued work here has been interrupted, and we hope that he can be released to come back and continue that work along with Harmeet and Tom and Jim, who all have been longtime activists for peace and for justice for the people of Iraq.
Well, Tim Nafziger, I want to thank you very much for being with us daily, the weekly vigil tomorrow again in Trafalgar Square here in London. And that does it for our broadcast. We are broadcasting from London through the week. Tomorrow is International Women's Day, and we'll be doing a special from here. You can email us with ideas or comments or suggestions for our British listeners and viewers. We welcome your suggestions of stories to cover while we're here at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Dennis Moynihan. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Uri Galed and Angela Alston, all the folks here in London. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.